As guiding light of the most influential paper in the capital of the most influential country in the Western Hemisphere, Katharine Graham has left an indelible mark on journalistic history. The reporting achievements that have brought acclaim to the post are innumerable, but surely among the first rank must be named the paper's dogged and forthright coverage of the Watergate scandal. Undoubtedly, you will recall Thomas Jefferson's famous remark, and I quote, "And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter," end of quote. With no small thanks to Katharine Graham and her investigative reporters, we have managed to preserve both government and a free, unfettered press. I read recently that the movie being made of the Post coverage of Watergate will have Mrs. Graham portrayed by actress Lauren Bacall. Now, that may be Hollywood's decision, but for us at Michigan State University, there is no substitute for the real thing. Therefore, I am delighted to present to you the real Katharine Graham.
President Wharton, graduates, faculty, and friends of Michigan State, it is indeed a terrific honor to have been invited to address the graduating class of so distinguished a university. Michigan State was once a pioneer among this country's land-grant colleges. Now it's a pioneer in the 20th century effort to reconcile the claims of practical and theoretical learning in a university setting. It's well known throughout the country for its excellence. In thinking over what I'd say to so formidable an audience, I, of course, resolved at the outset to avoid the conventional. However, in the stunning example of what we should nowadays call a person's prerogative, I changed my mind. For today, in the most time-honored, if not downright archaic tradition of commencement speakers everywhere, I intend to give you some unsolicited advice. It concerns what I take to be a rising tide of sentiment in the country against our public office holders and office seekers, an apparently pervasive feeling that the public has been so misused and misled by its elected officials that the only appropriate response is one of cynicism, disillusion, and contempt. It is this sentiment I wish to address today, and my message is fairly simple. I wish to speak in defense of politics and politicians. The attitude to which I'm referring will be all too familiar to you. In the wake of Vietnam, Watergate, and our country's economic and energy troubles, the polls have been very clear about this. The man in the street blames the man in office. Hardly a survey can be taken or an interview aired which does not inform us that the public is at a breaking point in terms of its confidence in those who govern. Our politicians, under this construction, are infinitely more devious and less decent than the rest of us. We should throw the rascals out, all of them. It is not, I think, to endorse the political corruption that does exist, or to be complacent about the condition of our political institutions, to register a strong protest against the premises that seem to underlie this line of thought. For one thing, you can cut the sanctimony and self-congratulations, and yes, self-deception, with an axe. my theoretical amalgam of the complaining citizen, who could be any of us, goes something like this. He or she gets up in the morning, yells at his children, speeds to work, elbows some colleague aside to gain a small advantage on the job, thinks about ways to cut corners on his income tax, and in the course of the day, tells 5 lies, 3 to other people and 2 to himself. At the end of the day, we find him leering at the evening news and the political figures who parade across it. He doesn't know how much longer the country can put up with such a hypocritical, self-serving crowd, he says to no one in particular. He himself has lost confidence in all of them. I'm aware that I've probably been unfair to this poor amalgamated fellow or person, but no more unfair than much of the public is being to its elected officials. My point is that the premise on which so much of the criticism rests is really faulty. I don't believe that the realm of politics and government constitutes a sort of separate culture, one that exists apart from the rest of our affairs, one peopled by uniquely penal and incompetent persons, or persons who are anything but a group. Our politicians are a reflection of ourselves. Not to put too fine a theological point on it, it is we who have created what is loosely known as the system, and we have created it in our own image. The notion that it is otherwise persists, and under some very strange circumstances. I'll offer here the sad example of Gordon Strong, one of the young Nixon aides who was undone by his part in Watergate, because it tells us so much about this particular form of blindness. Mr. Strawn came to Washington fairly new to politics, and he served as the most loyal of foot soldiers to Mr. Haldeman. In the course of that service, he permitted himself to become involved in some very unsavory activities. And then he was called to account before the Urban Committee in the Senate, forced to confront the consequences of his own behavior and to draw some conclusions from it. Mr. Strawn told the committee that he had indeed learned a lesson from what had befallen him. The lesson seemed to be that the system was at fault, for it was Mr. Strawn's view that he had been undone by his decision to take part in the world of politics and government at all. He advised young Americans watching him on television to stay away from Washington. The irony here is multiple and in a way monstrous. It's not just the fact that young Mr. Strawn and so many of the other Watergate fallen had the moral equation backward with respect to who had betrayed and done harm to whom. It is also, and perhaps more importantly, the fact that these people who contributed so heavily to the low esteem in which politics is now held by many Americans were not themselves politicians at all. And therein lay much of their problem. They were absolutists and zealots and causists. After a fashion, you might say they were even do-gooders gone wrong. I don't want to be misunderstood on this point. I believe there is a place in politics, as in every other area of life, for zeal. But I don't believe that zealotry, which is something quite different from zeal, is an acceptable substitute for politics. I believe it is the natural enemy of democratic politics, and therefore of political freedom. The late Judge Learned Hand, in my view, put it precisely. The spirit of liberty, he once said, is a spirit which is not too sure that it is right. Obviously, I'm defining politics here in its broadest and most basic sense as the means of resolving conflicts among legitimate and worthy claims on public institutions and resources. As a method of governing, Democratic politics is, in fact, one of the most demanding of all human arts. It requires reaching some just accommodation among interests that can never be wholly reconciled. It challenges people's skills of analysis, persuasion, and communication. Beyond that, politics asks for great compassion, an active regard for diversity, even when diversity proves inconvenient. Politics asks for the ability to tolerate frustration, cumbersome procedures, and all the lack of clarity and finality inherent in the workings of a free society. And precisely because it is so imperfect, so dependent for its successes on a capacity to listen, the political method is humanizing, as distinct from zealotry, which is dehumanizing. For a true politician, there are people out there to be accommodated, won over, dealt with fairly, argued with, explained to, and above all, learned from. For a zealot, there are only friends and enemies, and ultimately, enemies lists. The detachment and insensitivity and unconscious arrogance that go with a zealot's approach are insidious. Eventually, they reduce a cause to articles of faith that would be comic were they not in their implications so cruel. But it would be a mistake, I think, and a profound misreading of our contemporary history to conclude that the perpetrators of the Watergate scandals had some corner on this approach to public issues and public life. Well before they had decided that they would burglarize, bug, tap, and lie to the American public in order to, quote, protect it. The grisly motto had come back from Vietnam. We had to destroy the village in order to save it. And meanwhile, others, protesters here at home, were saying, we will stop the violence in Vietnam if we have to bomb innocent people here and destroy property that belongs to others to do it. This streak of unfeeling destructive do-goodism doesn't always reach terroristic proportions, but the we will save you even if we have to destroy you to do it argument does have a way of turning up in all manner of well-meaning causes. We will purify your air and protect your wilderness at any cost to you, a milder version goes, and we don't care if it costs you your job. Environmental gain versus economic well-being. National security requirements versus the claims of individual liberty. These are among the myriad conflicts that yield so much more humanely and sensibly to the political process than they do to the express train approach. I don't mean to suggest that the various protest and reform movements of the past decade have been unhealthy or unwarranted, or that they had little or no constructive effect. Through peaceful protests, the national conscience has been touched. National policies have been changed for the better, and Americans have gained a greater understanding of many injustices that require remedy. What I do want to propose is that we acknowledge arrogant and intemperate tendencies wherever they occur, even in movements and causes that we may regard as worthy. For the first casualty of such intemperance is almost invariably the capacity to see others, especially those who disagree, as human beings at all. The world outside the zealot quickly breaks down into stick figures, blacks and whites, racists and bleeding hearts, merchants of death, robber barons, right-wingers and left-wingers, welfare chiselers and the rest. And even when these blanket groupings of people are merely bland designations, as in the catch-all terms, businessmen or environmentalists, or the poor and the rich. They can be equally distorting to thought. Loyalties are chosen very often, and snap judgments made on the basis of which of these groupings is believed to favor or oppose whatever the project is at hand. The second casualty, then, of the causist approach is the independence of the causist himself. He has yielded up the ability to discriminate and judge and to particularize, and above all, to respond to the unexpected or changed circumstance. It is no accident that history is strewn with the wreckage of reform movements and rebellions, whose agents ultimately became indistinguishable from those they had replaced. That this was not been true of the American Revolution, which the nation is now prepared to commemorate, seems to me to be a tribute in very large part to the political genius of the founding fathers. They sought to create a structure of governance that depended on the kind of responsiveness and interconnection and balancing of competing claims that represent the political method at its best. All this is worth reflecting on today. We are, as a nation, at the end of an era of activism on many fronts, or at least in a period of great readjustment and change. Vietnam has altered our perception of our role abroad and caused us to think anew about the best way to fulfill our legitimate commitments overseas. The great civil rights confrontations of the 50s and 60s have brought us now to the harder and more intricate aspects of fulfilling the nation's commitment to racial justice, aspects that will not yield to confrontation or physical protest. The disclosure of governmental corruption has left us with a very difficult obligation, that of devising formulas for enforcing proper standards of behavior in our political life, without at the same time over-regulating that life and depriving our politics of its vitality and freedom. The condition of our economy has given the lie to past platitudes, reflexively stated by liberal and conservative economists alike. Abroad, the configuration of power, wealth, and influence is changing. At home, we are compelled to reconcile our own lives with these changes and to deal as well with the harsh effects of social, economic, and technological change on our style of living. I cannot think of a time when the strengths of our political process would be put more to the test than they will be now. But because each of these challenges to our ingenuity and civility as a nation is so intricate, and because each involves the well-being of us all, I cannot think of an array of public issues more suitable for resolution by that process. It therefore strikes me as preposterous to suggest that the shortcomings lately evident in our public life can somehow be remedied by purging politics from our national affairs. The real remedy, I think, is to try to instill more wisdom and humility in politics. Thus, we need not just more truth in our public affairs, but also more recognition that the truth is often complex and sometimes not very comforting. We need less arrogance about the views of others and more skepticism about our own. And perhaps most importantly, we need more simple, honest communications among ourselves. I would close by offering an example of the kind of public official I have in mind. When I speak of the distinction between zealotry and zeal, and when I seem to set so much store by politics, she is Congresswoman Barbara Jordan of Texas. She was black, female, and poor. But she managed over the years to challenge almost every hardened assumption of the community into which she was born regarding the possibility, even the propriety, of a person such as herself aspiring to be a lawyer, a state legislator, and a member of the United States Congress. No one who is familiar with these aspects of her career, or who saw her delivering her powerful We the People speech during the Judiciary Committee impeachment hearings, could accuse Barbara Jordan of a failure of passion or commitment to what she believes is right. And yet she is equally well known for her stubborn refusal to yield up her independence of judgment, or her human preferences and perceptions to the rigid demands of other people's causes, or to close herself off personally from those with whom she may disagree. Miss Jordan was once asked whether she'd been nervous when she first entered the all-male, all-white Texas State Senate. And she replied, "You must understand that I have a tremendous amount of faith in my own capacity. I know how to read and write and think. So I have no fear." The next order of business was to develop personal relations with other senators. Miss Jordan makes no bones about her calling, and she makes no apologies. "I am," she says, "a politician." That summarizes the spirit I would like to recommend to you today: the recognition that faith in the democratic system starts with faith in ourselves, and then the understanding that the system depends on human compassion and intelligence, and that politics so defined is not the enemy of change, but rather the instrument and governor of change, ensuring that the process will retain its sensitivity and human scale. Without that comprehension, all our other troubles will compound themselves. But if we can foster that spirit, as I think we can, our other difficulties can be addressed effectively and in a way becoming to a free society. Thank you and good luck.